unsurpassed, penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning. First, I would just like to say how very, very happy I am to be here. My husband asked me before I left, "So, are you excited about the trip?" And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, that's funny. I'm not excited. But I realized that the way I felt was the same way I always feel when I'm going home to visit my mother, which was, I'm going home to see my very good friends. And I realized that's new. And I have known so many of you for so long now that that's the way it feels, that you're just all my very old friends. And some of you are newer friends, but nevertheless, I have that feeling coming here now. I don't feel exactly like a guest anymore, which is a very nice feeling. So thank you. Second, I would like to thank you again for making such a big effort. Patty and Janie and Carol have been working very hard this last week and are completely exhausted. I don't even know how they're here today. Just to make this practice period happen, to make it possible for me to visit, because when you have a visitor, I mean, all of you know there's things that you have to get ready for that person, especially mean old Zen teachers, you know. You want to make sure everything is perfect, because after all, what will they say? What do you mean you've been going the other way? See, this is actually the advantage of being... I told them it's very bad juju to go the other way. That's right. Now you will all be instantly enlightened. Exactly. You see, this is the great thing about being the guiding teacher as opposed to the everyday teacher, is that I get to blow in, make all these changes, and blow out again. You can all hate me from afar. Actually, the reason that we do this is not because there's a right way or a wrong way or a good juju or a bad juju. It's so that when you go to other Soto Zen communities, you'll know precisely what to do. And believe me, they all walk clockwise in those zendos. So, I wanted to start today for the whole weekend. What I would like us to practice together is seamlessness. Suzuki Roshi talks about this a lot in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and then again in Not Always So. It's amazing how often actually the word comes up. And I think for years I did not know what he was talking about. But it was right there this morning. It's just amazing to me how these things happen. I was finishing up my notes last night, and then we started reading the Fukan Zazengi this morning, and I went, oh dear, there it is again. What a surprise. Even Dogen knew this. He says, the Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. That kind of blew me away the first few times I read it. What do you mean it's not meditation practice? I thought that's what Zazen meant. He says, it is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease, the practice realization of totally culminated enlightenment. It is the koan realized. Traps and snares can never reach it. And if you grasp this point, you are like a dragon gaining the water, like a tiger taking to the mountains. Why can't you just... energy, tiger taking to the mountains, yes. If you get this one point that Zazen is not meditation practice, it's not just this thing we're doing formally on our cushion. It is everything. So there's this wonderful poem by Ryokan, a great hermit, monk, poet. Talk is always easy. Practice always hard. It's no wonder people try to make up for their lack of hard practice with easy talk. But the harder they try, the worse things get. The more they talk, the more wrong they go. It's like pouring on oil to put out a fire. Just foolishness and nothing else. Ryokan is warning us, as so many teachers have, including Dogen, about second-hand living. Talk is easy. It's like they say, you know, even the devil can quote scripture. How many times have you had someone come up to you and say, oh, that is so Zen. Oh, I just want to scream. I was on the camping trip with my seventh graders this year, and we have a relatively new science teacher. He's only been around a year. And within the first 4 hours of being at the campsite, twice in a row, he's, oh yeah, it's really Zen. The second time I finally stopped him, I said, excuse me, I know you know this about me. I've been practicing Zen meditation for 25 years. I really have a hard time when people say something like, oh, that's so Zen. Oh, why? Because I said, it means anything to anyone then. It's just a word. Do you know what it actually means? Do you understand what you're saying? We had a great conversation then. So from then on in the trip, he'd say, that's so Zen. Oh, yeah. He's young and arrogant, what can I say? We'll whip him into shape. Talk is easy. To say, oh, that's so Zen, is easy. To actually do it, that's not so easy. Not only that, it isn't it. So it's rather like trying to talk to a blind person about the color red What do you say about the color red? It's red. It's a color. You have to see it to know that. I can say, oh, well, you know, it's like a fire. So the person is thinking to themselves, it burns? Let's see, a sunset. Well, can't see that either. How do you describe a color to a blind person? You can't. You have to experience red for yourself. So, Ryokan says, you know, the harder they try, the worse things get. The more words you keep adding to try and explain this color red, the more confused the poor person is going to be. Red is like flame, red is like a dragon, red is like fire, red is... It doesn't make any sense. Reading and talking about Zen Buddhism, they say, is sort of like eating a picture of a rice cracker. Not very nourishing, actually. It's the thing in a picture form, it's a symbol of it, but it's not the thing itself. So we all understand that, or we wouldn't be sitting here. I'm preaching to the choir. You all know that talking about it, studying it, it's all great stuff, and it makes for wonderful discussions. We have a great time doing it. But actually, the work that we're here to do is sitting on this cushion. So what people were studying during the practice period, Dogen's guidelines for studying the way, he talks about this several times, actually. At one point, he says, the study of the way should not be like Minister Shea's love for the dragon. There's a story of Minister Shea, who always was telling people how much he loved dragons. And one day, a dragon heard of this and came to his house and stuck his head in the window. And Minister Shea looked at him, went, and fainted dead away. Because the reality of things is not our idea of them. Be careful what you wish for. You wishing for dragons, they might actually appear. Words and scriptures, I mean, all these beautiful things we read, ideas, theories, opinions, all that stuff, they're not reality. They are, in a sense, dead words. And they cover the earth. Everywhere you go, you are bombarded by it. It's a different world than the Buddha lived in. You know, in the Buddha's time, when something happened an hour away, it probably took them a month to find out. They didn't have newspapers. They actually mostly didn't have a written tradition at that point. Everything was passed on orally. Now, you can't get away from it. Every store you go into, there's something on. Music, a TV. I was with my own teacher last Wednesday. He took me to this Japanese restaurant that's near his zendo because I was speaking that night. There was not only one, but two TVs in the Japanese restaurant. One above the bar, where he could see it perfectly. The other in the other direction, where I could see it perfectly. And he looked at me, and he looked at the TV, and he said, you are really lucky the Yankees are not on right now. But it's there in the background all the time, words. Last night, you know, Janie and Patty asked me about some guy who appears in a commercial. I stopped watching commercial TV years ago. Can't stand commercials. I'm really out of it for that reason. When my kids talk to me about stuff, it's like, don't know, sorry. I don't mind being out of it. Because I recently got a letter from my sister, who is a bit of a shut-in. She's had chronic fatigue syndrome for over 15 years, which means she watches a lot of TV. Now, she's a disabled person, and she's listening to all this stuff going on about the healthcare question. And this letter she writes me is really frightened. She says, I watch everything. I keep waiting for them to talk about what are they going to do about the disabled people? Are they just going to forget us altogether? Her whole letter was just fear. And I wrote her back, I said, you know, the first thing I would do if I were you is stop listening to all those things. I don't think President Obama is going to forget you because you're disabled. But this is the problem. We think words, ideas, opinions, commentary, essay, we think that's the real deal. They're not reality. They're somebody's idea of reality. And this is the measure of our delusion, actually. We believe these dead words, these dead ideas, and we think that they will liberate us. Oh, if I just read enough Zen books, I'll understand. Well, I don't know. I'm sure there are people who've even sat longer than I have here, and it is not my experience that it has enlightened me much more to read all the many Zen books that I have read. Every now and then there's an idea in there and I go, yes! But the reason I say yes is simply because it speaks to something that I already know. You know it. This is your birthright. You already know everything that you need to know. You just need to find out that it's in there, that you know it. So at some point, though, Ryokan says, you know, in the beginning, practice always hard. Why is practice hard? Why is there so much resistance to doing it? Because for all of us, there's some resistance. There is that resistance when the alarm goes off at 5:30 in the morning. Oh, I really would like to sleep another 15 minutes. I really should get up. Oh, but it would be just so nice to sleep another 5 minutes even. Get up. I still struggle. You know, 25 years later, and I'm still arguing with myself about getting out of the bed. Because it's cold out there, and it's nice and cold and cozy in here, you know. You know, practice is challenging. But like anything worthwhile, it takes work. It takes effort. You have to be committed. You have to make a decision that this is important. But most of all, you have to understand the idea of seamlessness. And at first, it's just an idea. What I hope is that for the rest of the weekend we practice this and then it's no longer just an idea, but it is your reality. Suzuki Roshi says it very clearly. A little different than Dogen, but same thing. Zazen practice and everyday activity are one thing. We call Zazen everyday life, and everyday life, Zazen. But usually we think, now Zazen is over, and we will go about our everyday activity. But this is not right understanding. They are the same thing. We have nowhere to escape. I hear him going, hee-hee-hee-hee-hee, after this. He did that every now and then. He would say something, you know, really, and then he'd come up with one of those little zingers at the end, and then there'd be this voice on the other end going, you thought I was going to say, everything be okay. No. We have nowhere to escape. Where is it we think we're going to go? You know, okay, so we do our zazen here, and then the bell rings, and we say, great, I'm done for the day. It doesn't work that way. This is just when the bell rings, maybe the end of your formal practice on the cushion. But it is only the beginning of your zazen for the day. There is nowhere to hide. As Sue was telling me, she was at Green Gulch, and this woman wanted to join her in the Zendo, and she said, oh, can I follow in behind and sort of, you know, be at the back? And she's like, there is no back. And this is really interesting, because in Vipassana practice, the way they do it, people gather in a group in front of the teacher in sort of circles, and they're all sitting in front of each other. So in fact, when I go to speak at the Insight Meditation Center that's near me, the Gil Fronsnell's group, there are many people who are at the back, and they are deliberately at the back. They're coming in because it's sort of like, well, I'll see how much I want to be here. And the door is right over there if I feel like I want to leave. No one will notice. I can slip in, I can slip out. But that's not our practice. Everybody sees everybody. There is no back. Truly, there's no front. It appears that there's a front because of the altar, but we're all together doing this thing. There is no time out. If the Zen teacher, after taking off his or her robes, acts differently in their work clothes, something is wrong. If the Zen student behaves immorally once they're out of the Zendo, something is wrong. It's an old story I was told one of my very first jobs, my last year of college. I worked for the planning department at my university as a sort of beginning graphic designer. And my boss, the day that I interviewed with him, I, of course, wore, you know, nice clothes for the interview. Then when I showed up for work, of course, I was a student in a California university, so I showed up in jeans because that had been what I was wearing to school. And he said, what's this? He said, this isn't what you wore to your interview. I said, no. That was for the interview, and you know, I'm supposed to get dressed up for interviews, but you know, this is what I wear when I'm going to class. And he said, this is rather like the story of the ditch digger. When he shows up, he's got this enormous shovel. The guy says, you're hired. And then on the day that the work begins, he shows up with this tiny little shovel. The guy says, wait a minute, what happened to your big shovel? Oh, that's just for the interview. There is nowhere to hide. There is nowhere to take time out. There is no way to misrepresent ourselves. What you see is what you get. And it has to carry all the way through, or it's a misunderstanding. When formal zazen ends, true practice begins. When we leave this cushion, we enter the world of activity. And each activity, each moment of the day, is an opportunity to express and manifest our zazen mind. Walking up the stairs, using the toilet, exercising the dog, sweeping, dusting, cooking food. Every moment. Walking to your car. Every moment is zazen. So Dogen says, the zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. In other words, it's not just this thing on our cushion. It's everything. It's in every moment. In each moment, we have the opportunity to completely be here or not. Sometimes we're not. And then we can catch ourselves and be here again. And then this world of activity. Remember in the Metta Sutta it says, standing or walking, sitting or lying down. That kind of covers everything. Okay? Whatever you're doing one of those things. Work, play, raising children, attending to your bodily functions, being sick. I once heard the most amazing thing about Charlotte Selver, who did the body awareness training. She sprained her ankle very badly. Now, most of us, when we sprain our ankle very badly, we're in trouble for at least a week, maybe more. Sometimes we have to be on crutches. But it's painful. So what did she do? She laid right down on her bed, propped her leg up, and for the next 24 hours did nothing but bodily awareness, meditation practice, sending energy to that place in her foot. And the next morning she got up and it was all better. Now, I don't know about you, but when I get sick, I tend to want to distract myself. I read books. You know, I'm lying in bed feeling miserable and I'm reading a book. Until I heard that story, it never dawned on me. Maybe what I should be doing is just zazen in bed to the best of my ability, sending energy to that part of my body that is not feeling well. Oh, what an idea, zazen. That is what she was doing. And lo and behold, her body heard, her body felt, her body cured. But we don't tend to think of zazen in that way. We tend to think of it as this thing I do here, and everything else is everything else. What we're really talking about here, the mind of zazen, is our intention, our attitude, our choices, moment after moment. In every single moment, a choice is being made. It's kind of overwhelming when you finally see that. To do this or to do that. To go this way, to go that way. To do or not to do, to be or not to be, as the poet would have it. Our decision, hopefully, is to say yes. To bring that zazen mind to each moment, to the best of our ability. And sometimes we may fall short of the mark. That's okay. It's to the best of our ability in each moment. And that is seamlessness. We do not do Zen. We do not go to Zen. We do not have a Zen practice. We are Zen. That's a very different thing. It's not something outside of us. It is us. I think this is why Suzuki Roshi, at one point late in the book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, says, you know, I think that Zen may be the religion before religion. Now, I had that typical question got asked of me a week ago of, so is Zen a religion or a philosophy? Oh, I hate that question. There's no good answer. So I told the person that. She loved that. She said, that makes perfect sense. I was like, thank goodness. Because on some level it looks religious. You know, there are priests. And on some other level it feels like a philosophical attitude to life. But the fact is, it is none of those things. It is just our natural self expressing Buddha mind, moment after moment. So, how do we do this seamlessness? What gets in our way? So I thought I would talk about work as an example, because for most of us, work outside of the home is a big part of our life. How do we take this formal practice back to the marketplace, to our homes, to our children? Because if we can't do that, what's the reason for doing it? We all came to practice because we wanted to wake up. For what reason? Because deep down we had an intuition that if we could just wake up to what was happening, what was really happening, we would suddenly be at ease with the universe. That everything would feel harmonious then. That no matter what difficulties life presented us, we would be able to meet them with some level of equanimity. That is a deep yearning, and it comes from a very real place. I worry, people say, you know, the reason, the ultimate value is happiness. I worry about that word. Not that I don't think there is tremendous joy in practice, but life presents us some very difficult, terrible situations. And I think it's asking a lot of someone to be happy when they have just received a diagnosis of cancer, when their mother has just passed away after a long illness, when their dog has died after 14 or 18 years of companionship. I don't think you're going to be happy about this. However, I do think that you can meet it with equanimity. That is possible. There is a stability about practice that allows us to do that. And that, my dear ones, is what we take to the world. We don't do it, you know, in a missionary way. Oh, I'm going to take this out to the world. Oh, those lucky people. No, it just happens very naturally. You can't do anything out there. You may think you're doing good work. You may think that you're being very charitable. You may think all kinds of things, but actually, it happens quite naturally. You don't have to try to make it happen. When this one here develops stability and confidence and equanimity, that's what you move in the world with. And other people are drawn to that. They don't understand why. But deep down, we're all drawn to that. We are not drawn to the hysterics in the room. We're drawn to the person who we know we can rely upon. We are drawn to the compassionate ones. We are drawn to the wise ones. This is because we have a survival instinct. We are drawn to those who are going to help us survive. Crazy, hysterical, outrageous people are not going to help us survive in hard times. They may be fun for a very short period of time, but most of us are not interested in living our life on the roller coaster that has no safety belt. We're not interested in being thrown out and hope that the parachute opens. What we want is reality. We want to stop missing our life. I remember very strongly that that was one of the main reasons I came to practice. There was this feeling. I don't know where it came from, how it started, but even as a child, this feeling, I was missing something. That something was always happening and I wasn't quite seeing it. I wasn't quite feeling it. And I don't know about you, but at 54, I'm on the other side now, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't know how many years I've got. I want to live life absolutely, completely, and for as long as I've got now. I think when you're really young, you think, you know, you've got years to have every experience in the world and be passionate and go for it. But, you know, none of us in this room are that young anymore. We don't want to be at the last moment in our life with any regrets. I didn't live my life. I didn't make it up with my father. Oh, I should have done more to help other people. Don't do this to yourself. When you're at that last moment, know that you lived completely, that you gave your all, and that all was given to you. So tomorrow, I'm going to talk a little about work practice and how we do that in the world and what gets in our way. But today, what I would ask of you, we will have a full day of zazen and meals and bathroom breaks and work practice. Stay in your zazen mind the whole day. No idle chatter. If you have to talk to someone about your job, fine. Stay here. Stay quiet. Stay focused. When you use the toilet, completely be your body. When you wash your hands, completely be your hands. When you wash the dishes, be the dish. When you ring the bells, be the bells. And when you hear the bells, be the bell. See if you can do that all day long. And what you will find is your mind will start quieting down because you'll be focusing so much on the thing you're doing. Last year, in the retreat that I did with Gil, my job was to wash the dishes for the evening. In order to keep my mind completely focused, I had to do it this way. Fork. Wash, rinse, place. Spoon, wash, rinse, place. In my mind, I was actually saying those words to keep myself here. Because as soon as I stopped doing that, errant thoughts began coming in. Oh, gee, so I wonder about the service that we did this morning. That's a little different. This whole counterclockwise thing. Yeah. And off your mind goes. Keep your mind here. Dish, wash, rinse, stack. Open door to toilet, close door. Whatever you need to do, stay with what you're doing. And then when you sit down, stay with your breath. Go away, come back.